and the Faith Uncut podcast, where we explore faith in ways that might get you kicked out of most churches. I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
Okay, so I guess first thing is where have we been? We haven't released an episode in, I think, over 3 weeks since we did the This Is America episode.
Yeah.
I'll shoulder that one because I had this idea after JW passed that we were going to do the show where we took all of these different moments from JW's time with us and play them and talk through them. And for a while, it took me a minute to just get the audio and pull the audio clips because every time I heard the voice, it was just like,
it was a lot.
And then that, you know, a week, 2 weeks went on and I was like, I really don't even want to do that show. Partly because like we have 55 episodes of JW speaking for himself and kind of cutting things up and using that kind of felt almost hologramish. Like, this is not really So I was like, I don't really want to do that. And then it just took me a while to get, you know, in the headspace to come back and have something to say. I'll tell you what helped. I did I sat down with the Brown Liquor Report, I guess 2 weeks ago now.
Okay.
And we just talked through some things, and it was their last, not their last episode, the two episodes ago.
Okay.
And it kind of got me, you know, stretching my legs a little bit again. So I was like, all right. So then that's what I've been dealing with for the past 3 weeks or so. Just trying to get past this significant loss and figuring out the best way to do it. But we're back. We got brought back from a listener who wanted us to have a conversation specifically about Hebrew Israelites. This was relating to the Nick Cannon, Professor Griff episode of the Nick Cannon's podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I don't remember the name of it. I don't care.
in the Nick of Time or something. But I don't know.
It's called Cannon something rules or something. I don't know. It's some college theme. I can't remember what it is.
Okay.
It's supposed to be about, you know, he's gone to Howard, so it's academic. And the conversation that they had was an interesting conversation that led to a lot of fallout, both sides. But more importantly, like I saw, and I think you did too, a lot of disagreement in my timeline about Nick was right, you know, Nick was wrong, Nick was anti-Semitic. And I didn't see a lot of nuance in that conversation. And first of all, the conversation is over an hour and a half. I watched the whole thing. And it's impossible to look at an hour and a half of a meandering conversation and just say Nick was right or Nick was wrong. So what was Nick or Griff right or wrong about is what I didn't see. And undergirding this entire conversation between the both of them were beliefs that align or come out of this Hebrew Israelite movement. And so I just wanted to talk through some of that. So Hebrew Israelites are Black people who believe that they are the tribe of Israel.
Yes.
The term Black Hebrew Israelites is derogatory to them because they don't see themselves as other. Like, so putting Black in front of it says that they're other than the Hebrew Israelites. They just look at themselves as the Hebrew Israelites. All right. So we're going to talk about that in a little bit. But because this was initiated by that Nick Cannon conversation, some of the things Nick said during the conversation, Nick asserted that melanin comes with compassion or salt. So if you have melanin, then you automatically have an increased quotient of compassion or soul. He said people who don't have melanin are, in his words, a little less, and they may not have the compassion. So he also said they're acting out of a deficiency. So by virtue of not having melanin or having a deficient amount of melanin, they are evil. They have to be savages, is what he said. He's describing this genetic defect during the conversation. He also said by 2050, every person will be a person of color. And then he went on to talk about the emasculation of the Black man, things like that. So what I'm saying is this conversation has a lot of things that if you listen to the conversation, you should be, they should set up some alarms for you. So like, as he's talking through basically race science, I'm asking myself the question, who knows better the damaging effects of race science than us.
Right.
Who's more thankful that race science has been debunked than us? Like, right. Don't we know better than to engage in conversations around race science? That doesn't make sense to me that you wouldn't know that. So tying that to having less of a soul or not having a soul or being less or being evil just because of a different quotient of melanin in your skin, it's hard for me to say or understand why anybody would say just that. That the melanin is the qualifier for these behavioral manifestations. So that I can't roll with. Like, that doesn't make sense. The other thing that I know that Nick was wrong about was it's by 2050, every person will be a person of color. It's not correct.
Yeah,
that's not what the data says. The data says that by 2050, there will be more people of color in the United States than white. Mm-hmm. And so that's the projection. And if that projection holds to be true, that doesn't mean that white people become people of color. That's just not
it. Right. Yeah, that statement wasn't factual.
Right. And then also he went into a long thing about the emasculation of the black man and how, you know, Dave Chappelle was right. He had to wear a dress at some point. It was a whole lot of stuff. And again, all of these things were not based in anything that we can measure or determine to be true, or they're not true. And there was no pushback in this. So, and when we're having a conversation about Nick was right, Nick was wrong, it's important to say to call out what those things are.
Okay. Right. So what would you say he was right about?
That Professor Griff was a part of Public Enemy.
I cannot stand you. Okay, true.
All right. Okay, so I guess what I want to focus on more is like the reason why this conversation happened the way it did.
Right. Okay.
And this conversation is not just a Nick and Griff conversation. It's just about the way that we have conversation. And they were having a conversation in a very black fashion. Like, this is like we do that. We do the same thing here. And so I just wanted to talk through the anatomy of that conversation.
I'm cracking up because it's trapped. We just worked out a whole bunch of shit before we turned on the record. But go ahead.
So as I'm listening to them, we had this conversation and they're trading bits of information, you know, true, not true, whatever. It occurred to me that the point of the conversation was not the information that they were sharing. The point of the conversation was about maintaining or fostering and maintaining relationship.
Okay. When you say fostering and maintaining relationship, who are you talking about the relationship between?
Between the two people in conversation or however many people in conversation.
Okay. So you think they use the conversation as a bonding technique or tool?
Right. Okay. And so that was evidenced by like finishing each other's thought, which aids agreement in a conversation, and it continues to foster that bond that we've actually done something together. We've had this conversation. Doesn't matter what we're talking about. We're doing it. They affirmed blackness throughout the conversation, which is super important for the way that we interact with each other. There was a lot of mutual agreement, whether they should have been agreeing or not. Again, the point wasn't the being right or wrong. The point was having the conversation. Mm-hmm. Each person had these opportunities to teach and to learn, even though there wasn't much learning going on because there wasn't much information presented that was contrary to what they initially thought. Mm-hmm. But each person had their opportunity to share information. So like the other person's kind of listening, kind of learning, but they already agree. So each person has a chance to talk. So because the conversation supersedes the information being shared in the conversation, it kind of meanders. Like they go from one topic to the next. It's not really focused on one specific thing. You say one thing and you say like, yeah, I like bananas. You're like, yeah, Golden Girls is my favorite. And like, yeah, right. Like it was just kind of going all over the place. And again, the point wasn't what they were saying. It's just that they're saying it to each other.
Right.
They discuss facts, no citations, no way to go back and understand or look more into those facts. The facts are inaccurate. No one corrects inaccurate information. Mm-hmm. There's no disagreement present in that conversation. Mm-hmm. And so the way I looked at it, it was obvious to me after an hour and a half of this conversation that I wish I didn't have to listen to, was that they really just valued each other, and mm-hmm. they were just talking and valuing each other. The problem is, you know, what they ended up talking about and how, because there was no critical engagement of the information, and the conversation just kind of went without any wherever checks. And they ended up in a lot of spaces that really weren't helpful. They really
and definitely weren't helpful once you come out of that bubble of confirmation bias and the echo chamber that's created when there is no disagreement present, and you open the door and it's like, we disagree with you. So he opened the door to a firestorm after having this very cocooned conversation with this entity that, when you say there was no real learning taking place, or because there were a lot of, you know, tidbits flying around, but no citations, no critical thought, no critical application, and understanding the value of the conversation at all between the two participants, regardless of the information that they're presenting, it almost sounds like a trauma bond. Like you're taking the time and you're bonding over this great time that you're having this conversation with, you know, this other Black man, this maybe somebody you looked up to, or you always wondered why they were so militant, you know. Oh, people know you for this, they know you for that. I mean, it's not like people are looking at Nick Cannon and saying, yes, you are a pillar of Black resistance and, you know, fight the power, whatever, the way that they might do with Griff. So right or wrong. So they're sitting there and they're trauma bonding, because here's a space for that we're occupying, taking up space, as we say, two Black men talking about what they want to talk about or what they thought they wanted to talk about. Mm-hmm. It sounds like a trauma bond.
Right. Where they started is not where they ended, because that's just the nature of that type of conversation. And as I was watching it reminded me of the griot tradition. Mm-hmm. Now, griots in West Africa, or jollies, however we want to call them, it was a family of people who carried the information to the people around them. Mm-hmm. And so when you have griots, like, they're trained from when they're children by the older griots in their family. And when people get together, they share the information. Everyone's attentive. Everyone's watching or learning or whatever. Now, griots are great, but they're also not griots. The people who are not griots. And those people, whether they are listening to the information, not a part of that family, or maybe they're not yet griots, you can imagine that those people have a desire to be in that position of the center of attention, getting in and sharing the information, mm-hmm. and everyone paying attention to them. But let's take, for instance, a griot in training who doesn't know all of the information yet. They may, if they were in that position, it may be a little clumsy and awkward. You know, they may not have everything together. And so the image in my mind is, it's a nerdy image, but it's a video game called Final Fantasy. And Final Fantasy, there's the hero Cloud, who has this enormous broadsword, this two-handed sword. Cloud, the sword is like at least twice the size of the human, the person, Cloud. I'm always wondering, like, how does he handle that sword? How does he, you know, carry that and swing it and fight with it and stuff like that? And that's kind of what this conversation felt like. It felt like two people who didn't have a grasp of the information sharing the information in a clumsy way. And if you allow that to happen, somebody's gonna get hurt. Somebody's gonna get cut with that sword. It could be you. And in this case, it was Nick Cannon. So I said earlier about the beliefs undergirding a lot of this conversation, the Hebrew Israelites. There was so much in this conversation. I don't even think they said that at any point throughout the conversation, but I recognized those beliefs as they were having the conversation. And so because we encounter them so much, whether through family, friends, or, you know, social media or whatever, I just kind of wanted to talk through what these beliefs are, you know, where they come from and things like that.
Well, first, let's go back. Before we even go into Black, the Hebrew Israelites, let's just set the foundation for where some of these types of beliefs could be rooted from. We just said that we're operating within this void of having been cut off from the verifiable lineage that we know ourselves to be. So Black people in general do struggle with, where is my root? And
that is a community-wide phenomenon. So those of us who cling, like you talk about griots, the griot tradition, you might even recognize that in your family, the elders who are charged with telling you the family lineage, it might not be documented, or they might be encouraging younger people to write down, you know, who are all the siblings that belong to the grandparents? Who do the grandparents belong to? You know, how far back can you go? And it ends up being a phenomenon that we have, you know, if you have a family reunion tradition in your family, where you actually are coming together to affirm the history that you know, to take account of the new children, or to take account of the new movements in the family. So we've built up these others, cultural adherences that have always spoken to this void of being cut off from what we would call a verifiable historical lineage that tells us what we're looking for. So in this environment, you have these types of things espousing that say, well, actually, we're from here. Actually, this is, you know, what it is. So this Hebrew Israelite tradition occupies some of that space where the blend between our historical knowledge of our lineage and our understanding of our spiritual lineage as well.
That is a great point to bring up. The disconnection from your cultural identity is a forever injury to Black people. It's something that cannot be repaired. And what it's led to is that search or that never ending quest for identity. Mm-hmm. And so that's manifested in different ways historically. Marcus Garvey spoke to a lot of that and connected or resonated with a lot of people. But when Garvey got deported back to the Caribbean, that left a void for a lot of people. And in that void, we started to see people step in and meet that need. So we saw Noble Drew Ali with the Moore Science Temple in New York, Elijah Muhammad with the Nation of Islam. And these are people who are starting to speak to that lack of community or connecting who we are now with who we were. Clarence 13X from the Nation of Islam in the 60s had this idea that we are all gods. And so out of these different movements that kind of went into that Garvey void when he was gone, the Hebrew Israelites is something that comes out of that. And so it's important to know that these are not just Black people sitting around saying we want to do this or we want to, you know, we want
to. Absolutely not.
It's because we're trying to find something that was taken from us that can't be brought back, that can't be reconnected.
And we're doing it in this. Not only is that what's happening that we're trying to reconnect, but a lot of times we are approaching this body of knowledge or approaching these reconnections with either the idea or what we think is the manifested reality that no one wants us to do it. You see what I'm saying? So the more controversial things sound, the more right sometimes people are inclined to think they are about it, because it's like, oh my gosh, that is the wildest shit. That must be what it is. You see what I'm saying?
It resonates because you know something's missing.
And you feel like that missing part, that's the part nobody wants us to know that. So that ridiculous shit ends up taking root in that space because you've decided no one wants us to know who we really are. I mean, like who's the no one? Just like we were talking about the unnamed they. You know what I mean?
I don't know if this is a thing that can ever be solved because you can't fill in that gap of information, someone can always put something in there that's going to have to either be affirmed or debunked. But at whatever point they put it in, it sounds like it could be it. It could be the thing that's been missing this entire time. And so the Black people would identify with this Jewish liberation story. And so what happened was, as they started to identify with this story, they would look in the scriptures. So for instance, Deuteronomy 28 is where a lot of this comes from, the blessings and the curses. So in Deuteronomy 28:25, it says, the Lord will cause you to be defeated before your enemies. Verses 32 and 33 says, your sons and daughters shall be given to another people while you look on. You will strain your eyes looking for them all day, but be powerless to do anything. A people whom you do not know shall eat up the fruit of your ground and all of your labors. You shall be continually abused and crushed. That's Black people in the United States. Mm-hmm. In 36:37, it says, the Lord will bring you to a nation neither you nor your ancestors have known, where you shall serve the gods of wood and stone. In verse 64, 65 of 28, it says, the Lord will scatter you among all peoples, from one end of the earth to the other, and there you shall serve other gods of wood and stone, which neither you nor your ancestors have known. Among these nations, you shall find no ease. And so Black people looking at that liberation story of Israel saying, that's God talking about us. Like, that's us. It's and even in 2868 says, the Lord will bring you back in ships to Egypt. There you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves. Now, for Black people looking for where do we come from, who we are, because it's not just identity. It's also significance. It's also dignity. It's these things that have been taken. And so in the Exodus or the Jewish liberation story, Black people can look at themselves and find themselves there. And then some Black people go as far as to transpose themselves into the story. So that's part of where this comes from. So you got Black people looking at the story and identifying with the story. And you have Black people looking at the story and transposing themselves into the story. The problem becomes, especially for Hebrew Israelites, Black people who look at the story and claim that the story is exclusively about them, that's where the anti-Semitism comes in for this point. Because if you're saying this is Black people and not descendants of Israel or Jewish people, then you've taken that identity from somewhere else. In your search for identity, you've attempted to remove it for another group of people. Mm-hmm. And so that's important to understand as we start to have some of these conversations. For Hebrew Israelites, saying that you are the true descendants of Israel is at its heart anti-Semitic, because you're excluding someone else from that. Mm-hmm. You're taking that, you're injuring them to correct your injury. And so where did we get this from? It's not just Deuteronomy 28. There was a guy in 1976, Arthur Kessler, who wrote this book called The 13th Tribe. He was a Jewish guy. And in the book, Kessler raises this thing called the Khazar conspiracy. Mm-hmm. Now, real quick, there's basically two types of Jews. There are the Sephardim Jews and the Ashkenazim Jews. The Sephardim Jews, they went into the Iberian Peninsula after the Babylonian exile. And so they settled in Southern Europe, in the Balkans, and in North Africa. The Ashkenazim Jews, after the Roman exile, they settled in the Danube Valley. And these are the people that went to Germany and France. Mm-hmm. And so if you look at the where these two groups settled, you can see why the one group, the Ashkenazim Jews, present more white in Germany and France than the other mm-hmm. group who went Southern Europe, the Balkans, and North
yeah,
Africa.
Yeah, Mediterranean.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so the theory from Kessler says that the Ashkenazi Jews, instead of being from Israel, they were descended from this area of Khazaria, which is not biblical Israel. And he initially presented this as an academic theory, but the way he presented it, he wasn't intending to be anti-Semitic. But because he said that the Ashkenazi Jews, or these white-presenting Jews, were from this other area, not Israel, that got picked up by Palestinian leaders and said, y'all have no claim to this land. So y'all are not from here. This theory says that y'all are not from here. This land is ours. And so that ended up being the thing that was the impetus for all of this damage to this group of people. Again, just like the Hebrew Israelites had taken this identity from this people, this theory from Kessler, the Khazar conspiracy, which was has been debunked, is saying that y'all don't belong here. This is not your thing. Now, this was, they did a lot of DNA evidence to determine that there's no genetic markers in Ashkenazi Jews linking them to Khazaria. So this was, they did this research after Kessler wrote this book in 1976. And this is one of the many reasons that this conspiracy theory was debunked. And so at any point when you say you're not of this area, or you're not these people, or you don't belong to this God, you're taking something away from someone, but it's for the purpose of doing something else to them. And mm-hmm. so that's the anti-Semitism behind some of these beliefs. It's important to be aware that as we're starting to have some of these conversations where we prioritize the relationship of the conversation over the information exchanged in the conversation, mm-hmm. because you could very easily, if you haven't taken some time to critically think through this, fall into a place where you're doing harm to someone else just because they are a certain type of Jew or you believe them to be something that they may not be. And so that's one of the things that this conversation brought out as people start to say that basically Jews aren't Jews. Blacks are Jews. Y'all are not. Mm. Yeah, that's. Mm.
It's so much here. I mean, I don't mean to make you carry the majority of the conversation, but you know, these conversations are not for the intellectually lazy. So really what happened, I think primarily between Cannon and Griff is that not only was that traumatic bonding present where we're going to talk about something that doesn't ultimately leave us victimized. You know, if we're going to discuss our victimization, we're actually going to be able to discuss it to the affirmative in that we know exactly why it's happening and exactly who is, you know, responsible for it. And, you know, that shit is horrible, but really what we've come to do, what we've come together to do is accuse as opposed to show evidence or demonstrate or whatever. How and ever, these are not conversations for the intellectually lazy. You know, we've talked about echo chambers. We've talked about going to Google and Googling what you're looking for and taking the hits that only agree with you. This is what we're talking about as far as primary sources, secondary sources, subjecting yourself to the rigor and the discipline of processing information, because these are things that you can feel very strongly about, regardless of what the evidence says. You can feel very strongly about your opinions and your experiences with a group. Black people know that through and through. People feel very strongly about us. I've never seen a Black person in real life in their life. But you can go talk to, you know, certain people and they'd be like, they're all like this. So when you have that shoe on your foot, you should be very careful to not step on someone's toes and not force somebody else's foot into that. But again, a lot of these conversations and discussions are going to have to take into account that Black people talking about certain things through their lived experience of anti-Blackness is going to make a lot of people uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And I don't know that they're going to vacate how they feel about it for what so-called evidence says when, as we acknowledged earlier, there's this idea that all evidence that would put things in our favor has been distorted. Furthermore, I think it's important to not say that only Hebrew Israelites are subject to finding this dignity and this standing in this particular passage about who they might have come from and who they might be, because Black American Christians do the same thing.
As do white Christians. White American Christians also transpose themselves into this story.
Right. So if we say that there's danger in doing that, then there must be danger in everybody doing it.
So I think the nuance there is, as people read the Bible or whatever your holy text is, to be able to see yourself in the story is human. That makes sense.
That's inspiration.
Right. That's how the text become or stay relevant to you. So I think that that part is okay. I think the part that the dangerous part is once you do that to the exclusion of other people, it's mm-hmm. me and only me and not you. And so that's the problem.
Okay. All right. I will give all of us that. I just want to be, the term that's jumping in my mind is keep that shit real. Keep it real. These things are not happening just amongst people who are just mediocre in, let's say, a learning space or intellectual space. This is happening. This conversation has been had, you know, not for the benefit of a podcast audience, not for the benefit of public consumption. It happens in spaces where people feel safe to express themselves. It happens in spaces where hopefully people feel safe to be corrected if somehow their delivery is off or their facts are not valid. And I think that part of what happened in Cannon's controversy that stood out to me is that even as he was being told he was wrong, he said, teach me. And he was corrected harshly in certain ways or appeared to be certain ways before he was actually, you know, engaged on that level of teaching. So we have to be careful, because I feel like that happens all the time where people say, it's not my job to teach you, but you have to not throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because here is somebody who's a sponge right now. College student, has definitely had all these experiences, has money. Him going to Howard, it has nothing to do with him trying to get a better job, as it, you know, as it does for so many other people. Him going to Howard has a lot to do with that same search for rooting. Where can I find a body of knowledge that I can trust when it comes to me and myself and my interests? So him turning out and saying, teach me if I'm wrong, you know, show me or help me understand. I understand that we don't always want to do that for people because we're like, do your work. But here is a situation where I do feel like he would have benefited or will benefit from people taking the time to debunk and reestablish, because all of that information in that stoop is existing because what? In that stoop, he can get his dignity. In that stoop, he matters. His experiences are valid. He is centered. There are certain things that these groups do well as far as, you know, what do we talk about? You know, Black people standing up on their own too, or standing out in front or being proud. There are certain things that these groups do well because they center us. There are other things that are not done well because in centering us, other people and other groups just fall off the plate. We don't care what happens. That cannot be, you know, the ultimate posture of these ideologies that we want to be positive for us. The flip side to that is, I don't know. And I'm just saying this for fairness sake. Our expectations of ourselves are very high because we are reading the evidence that in certain situations, we are the people who are not centered and pushed off the plate. And then as we get recentering, we're expected to do it better than it was done to us. And I'm just saying that that takes time and practice and real intention and effort.
I agree with what you're saying. To me, Nick kind of did this out of order. So he had this conversation where it appeared authoritative, and it was not. He still had a lot of learning to do, which he later admitted. So after he has this conversation where he appears to be leading the discussion, then he doubles down and says, nope, I stand by what I said. Then he comes back and says, I still want to be taught. Teach me. And so then, you know, all of the stuff came out. Then he comes back and says, you know, he's trying to learn. He wants to be better and things like that. So this is kind of out of order. Like the best way to do that is to say, hey, I want to learn. Let me learn. And then, you know, you come back and say, teach me. That's his third step. So the fourth step he should have done first. The third step he should have done second. Then, you know, then he does the first step, which is you have the conversation, and then you can stand by what you say. So he did. It was out of.
Even with you saying it like that, though, I'm wondering how much, you know, in all of this controversy. And like I said, I left it to you to consume the interview so that we could just have kind of have two clean different perspectives. But something that's standing out to me now is that Griff is not new to these types of controversies.
No.
And if you're saying that Nick led this conversation,
it was him and Griff. It wasn't him. It wasn't him leading. Oh. Griff is the OG of this conversation.
So, okay. I think what I was getting at is just that, you know, you also have to be careful for people who will use your naivete to prove a point for themselves or to, you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah,
like they'll
beat
you up because they know how it's going to go, or they know they could imagine. And I'm saying, wow, Cannon is taking a lot of, you know, heat for this, but Griff ass has been involved in a bunch of stuff.
Yep.
So, okay.
Yeah, I mean, he got himself kicked out of Public Enemy for it, and then he came and got Nick kicked out of all his shit for the same thing.
Loving company, what is going on?
But okay. There was a thing that you said that kind of is still sticking with me. The way that we have these conversations, it's important for us to be able to, we can still prioritize relationship, but we should be in the conversations also for the purpose of exchanging good information. Like, you don't want to leave. Like, if you care about the relationship, you don't want somebody out there looking dumb. Like, I get mad if somebody, you know, after, you know, I get home all day and my wife is like, oh, you got some broccoli in your teeth. And I'm like, well, no one told me this all day. You know what I'm saying? I've been walking
all day.
Lunch. I've been walking around with this. And so, like, for us to do that to each other, we're really not prioritizing a relationship if we're afraid to get in and engage and correct and things like that. But the damage that has been done to Black people from this, that has led to all of these things that we walk through, is something that we have to reckon with and also be allowed to reckon with. Like you said, people's experience does color the way that they engage other people. So someone who has never had to engage the police is going to have a different view of the police than I do. And it's important to give voice to this different experience that, yeah, you, the police are fine for you. They help you. They terrorize me. And here are the reasons why. So you, I think that you're bringing up a good point that experience does matter. Mm-hmm. We just have to be responsible about how we deploy that experience. Mm-hmm. Like you say, it can't be the just the nebulous day, or, you know what I'm saying? If you have experience, I should be talking about my experience.
I just want to talk about the revolutionary power of that. You know, if you're saying, and I agree with this, you know, can't speak to the unspoken they, you, or the unidentified they, or this group, and not be specific. All I'm saying is germane to the African-American experience is replacing people's personal injuries to ourselves, our families, our economy, our businesses has been anonymity. They get to do these things in anonymity. I don't know who did it. I don't know who did what. Even the idea of a Klansman. We got hoods and shit because you get to do this in anonymity. So the most revolutionary thing when we're talking about our experiences is being able to speak truth to power and say who did what. That's huge. Yeah. So people don't, in the conditioning of getting out of saying, you know, oh, it was Mr. James who did X, Y, Z, and moving to a part of, I don't know, that has to do with kind of that doubling down on feeling powerless about a situation, hopeless about a situation, feeling like there's no justice, there will be no fairness, there will be no good outcome for me, you know, in naming who might have harmed me or who has hurt me. The problem with structural and systemic issues is that sometimes you don't know who it is. You don't know who to blame. You don't know who to say did this one thing. So when we say that this is not an intellectually lazy conversation, it's not morally lazy either. You have to call things as though they were. So if a person has done something to you, and you can, and you know it, and you can demonstrate it, you can prove it. Truth to power is saying you did that, mm-hmm. not y'all did that, right? So we have this issue. Black people have this issue. Y'all, it's not us. It's a specific person. Speak truth to power and say what happened.
Yeah. The other thing that you said that was on my mind was that as Black people try to fill in these gaps of identity and dignity and significance, as we try to do that, there's a lack of trust for a lot of things. We can't trust what we know. And then a lot of times we can't trust what we learn because mm-hmm. we have to do not only the work of filling in something that we shouldn't have to, but then we have to do the work of vetting the information that we receive, which we shouldn't have to because we didn't write those histories. So where are the histories that actually affirm us or that don't take away from us, or who wrote this? It's an impossible task to try to re-engineer a genealogy or a history using the information of the person who took that from you. And so the task is exceedingly difficult as we try to get through. Even like you say, it's not for the intellectually lazy, but the rigor that's required to get through this is, I don't even know how to describe it. That's the extent of the injury. Not only do you not have the connection, but you have to use our information to try to piece together the connection. And we know we didn't keep those records accurately. We know we didn't keep those records with you in mind. What does that mean for your search for identity and significance where you don't have the information and the information that you do have, you can't trust? That's how you get to a lot of these ideas. Because Black people are doing the best they can with what they have or what they've been given. And so it's difficult. I think that there should be some grace applied to that. For anyone that's willing to learn, yes, do that. Learn. Do everything that you can. But Black people have to be afforded mistakes because we're not intentionally setting out to harm. We're setting out to heal. Heal us. And find those connections, reconnect the thing that was broken. And in looking for that, we end up in spaces that we may not know are dangerous until we actually get into it and look around a little bit more. So Nick wasn't right. Nick at points was anti-Semitic. Absolutely. And Nick is learning and Nick is injured. And so how do we correct all of this without just tossing away a person? I think the posture of learning is where we all need to be. But also there's a posture of grace of saying, oh, they're doing something that I don't even have any idea how I could do if that were me. How do I find my people? How do I find where I come from?
I don't know. I just, you know, that is the question. Because for me, that's where it all comes back to. Like, this controversy is not so much sprung out of the outcomes of the conversation. It's the inputs. It's the foundations of why such a conversation would need to happen at all. What persists? And when you say it's an injury that cannot be healed, it represents itself in every generation. So he's asking questions in 2020 that were being asked in 1920, that were being asked in 1820, that were being asked in 1720, because by 1720, we had already been here for 112 years. And you could have lost that by the time somebody becomes a grandparent, if not, you know, later parenting. So I think that was my whole concern, you know, and just even getting prepped for the show. Let's not be disingenuous that even these types of conversations are not happening because of the persistence of an inequity and a lack of access to solid information that you can trust that will tell you a truth that you need to know. It doesn't exist a lot of time for us, which will give rise to the conspiracy theories or to the one person's conspiracy theory is another person's unearthed truth. Like, we have to just kind of put things out there and say, we know it probably sounds good, but it's not good, right? So what we've identified in this is that how you feel about a thing might not really be what the thing is. So how you feel about your treatment might not be what a thing is, what is causing it, or what is contributing to what you're experiencing at the time. Where does that work in for us? Where does
It's so
we tied.
Right, we are. and as we're looking for, as we're on this constant search for identity and dignity and significance, it's important to know, to recognize when you're gone down the wrong path, because the person who turns back first is the person who's making the most progress. And for the record, Hebrew Israelites is the wrong path. For these reasons, it cannot be the voice of Black liberation or Black affirmation or Black identity, because it does not affirm all Black people.
Absolutely.
The misogyny that exists in Hebrew Israelite communities does not affirm Black women. The homophobia does not affirm LGBTQ Blacks, even Africans. So there's an interesting notion about what they believe. They only claim the Israelite identity for the non-African. So it's the Blacks that boarded the ships and survived the Middle Passage and survived slavery that they believe are the true Israelites. The Africans who stayed in Africa are not that left behind. They're not that tribe.
Mm-hmm.
So that quirk in what they believe is does not affirm Black identity. It doesn't. It segregates out this little sliver of Blackness, this survivor of slavery, male dominant, straight culture. That's not the voice of Black liberation. It can't be under no circumstances. And so if we recognize we're down the wrong path, make the progress and turn around, find the other path. This thing, like you said, it resurges every generation because the answers aren't there. And every generation of Black people is going to be looking for the answer. Who am I? Why am I here? Why am I dealing with this? Why do I matter?
Yeah.
We can't stop it. We just got to keep going forward and learning, mistakes and all.
Yeah, don't get laid down behind the easy grabs. Those can weigh you down and you won't progress to where you need to be. So I hope we all learned something.
Yeah.
I hope we all learned a lesson.
For Faith Uncut, I'm your host, Mike.
And I'm Amira.
For more on Faith Uncut, Check us out at faithuncut.com.